Iran says it will respond to any threats against its security after the U.S., Israel, and Britain blamed Tehran, without any proof, for an attack on an Israeli-managed tanker. The senior Cuban official says that the U.S. is engaged in a propaganda campaign to destabilize the Caribbean state. And Israel's Supreme Court is set to rule on the planned eviction of Palestinians from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of occupied outlets. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran pledges a prompt and strong response to any possible threat after Britain, the U.S., and Israel blamed Tehran for an attack on an Israeli-managed tanker. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said that Iran will not hesitate to protect its security and national interests. Earlier, an informed source told the media close to Iran's Supreme National Security Council that the U.S. and the U.K. will be responsible for the consequences of any move against the Islamic Republic. The U.S., Britain, and Israel blame Iran for a Thursday drone strike on an Israeli-affiliated oil tanker off Oman. They have offered no proof for their accusation, but threatened to react to the attack. Earlier resistance sources told Al Alam Arabic News Network that the attack was in retaliation for Israel's airstrike on an airport in Syria's Qusair region. Author and journalist Robert Fantina says that the U.S. and the U.K. are following suit on Israel to blame the oil tanker attack on Iran because it is simply their enemy.
The United States trying to control the narrative and saying that Iran is an enemy of the world. This is complete hypocrisy. This is a complete lie and a complete myth. As you mentioned, Israel and the United States are accusing Iran of this attack without any evidence. The U.S. is looking for any reason at all to raise tensions with Iran because Iran is a major player in the Middle East and the U.S. only wants Israel to be a major player in the Middle East. Israel, with its constant violations of international law, its constant crimes against humanity, its constant violations of the human rights of the Palestinian people, is in no position to accuse anybody else of anything. So this is, again, it's posturing by the United States and Israel and the UK, which is following along. One country can't completely ignore international law, disdain diplomacy, and run roughshod over the world and expect that there will be no consequences. Iran is a powerful country. Yemen is one of its allies. Syria is an ally. So attacks against these nations are certainly going to have consequences. And Israel and the United States have to expect those consequences and deal with them. The way to not deal with them is to not have them in the first place. So if the United States and Israel would cease their aggressive actions, then there wouldn't be any consequences. And again, with this most recent one, there is no evidence yet of who perpetrated this attack. It might have been, we don't know who it was. Yet Israel is willing to assume it was Iran because it considers Iran an enemy, and the United States is simply going to follow along.
The Cuban ambassador to the Vienna-based international organization, Marlon Redondo, has accused the U.S. of engaging in a propaganda campaign to destabilize her country.
Previous weeks, it was developed a manipulation and communication campaign financed by the U.S. with the objective of inciting, encouraging people to go out to the streets with the objective of encouraging instability in the country. And they took the opportunity, the advantage of the real hard situation that Cuba is living right now due to the pandemic, due to the reinforcement of the blockade, with the application of more than 240 measures during the Trump administration. And they took that advantage to do their campaign. And during those weeks, they were inciting to violence. They were calling for vandalism acts.
Redondo explained how the current U.S. administration is advancing his predecessor's disinformation campaign against Cuba over recent protests there. Redondo blamed Washington for fueling the unrest in the Caribbean nation. Last month, the U.S. imposed new sanctions against Cuba, citing alleged human rights abuses and the detention of protesters. Cuban officials said that Washington's arbitrary measures were aimed at justifying its economic blockade against their country. Cuba has witnessed protests recently over an ongoing economic crisis. Havana blames Washington's decades-long embargo and sanctions for the country's financial downturn. Israel's Supreme Court is set to rule on the planned eviction of Palestinians from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of occupied Al-Quds. Monday's verdict could lead to forcible removal of Palestinians from their ancestral homes to make way for the regime to build settler units. The ruling was delayed after the Attorney General requested more time to study the case in May. The Israeli plan had sparked anger and protests, which were met with a crackdown by regime forces, leaving hundreds of Palestinians injured. Since May clashes, Sheikh Jarrah has been blockaded by Israeli troops, which locals say amounts to a siege. The case has also captured global attention, with international rights groups accusing Israel of plotting to grab more land in occupied territories to hand them over to settlers. Well, Israel's Supreme Court is set to rule on the planned eviction of Palestinians from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in occupied Al-Quds. Earlier, we discussed that issue in our news review program.
So let me invite a couple of guests to see what's going on there. We'll have our correspondent, Ramala Mona Kandil, and Daud Kitab, journalists and commentators, also joining us from Amman, Jordan. Good to have you both. Let's go to Ramala Mona. Stage are we now? I wonder when the court will be held and when we should be expecting this ruling, and more importantly, the possibility of the Palestinians getting the chance to stay where they have been staying, or just do they have to leave?
Well, the Israeli Supreme Court was supposed to be held at 11 local time. However, it was postponed for more hours. Now, as you have mentioned, the verdict that is expected, it would be, according to the Israeli media and the Israeli court, it would be the final saying. The verdict expected in the final hearing that could lead to forcibly displace four Palestinian families in favor of Israeli settlers. So those Palestinian families, if the Israeli Supreme Court decided and issued its final hearing, decided that they should leave their homes, these homes would be those Palestinians would be forcibly evacuated from their homes, and settlers would be brought to live in these homes. We are speaking today about four families. They are part of 28 families from the Sheikh Jarrah, part of more than 500 Palestinians who had been living in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Al-Quds since the 1967. The final saying and the final verdict would be issued maybe in a couple of hours. However, it seems that the Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah had been protesting in the last few days. Mainly Israeli forces raided the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood on Saturday and on Sunday, and they sprayed skunk water at the protesters in order to prevent them from showing any solidarity action with the families of the Sheikh Jarrah.
Now, let me turn to Amman and ask Mr. Kitab the reason why the Palestinians should be waiting for a court ruling. They have been living there generation after generation for ages. It's their home. Why should a court decide for them?
Well, the whole case is a case of racist ethnic cleansing. The Israelis and the Jewish settler organization claims that the land in which the Arabs built the homes on, the Jordanian government in 1950 built the homes in cooperation with UNRWA, back in 1848 belonged to a Jewish family. There's no proof of that, and they're claiming that this is their land, and therefore what is built on their land is theirs. It's such a bizarre case in which the Jews demand that land that they owned hundreds of years ago should go to them, whereas Palestinians who were kicked out of their homes just a few years ago are not allowed to reclaim their homes in West Jerusalem or in Israel proper. So it's a very discriminatory laws that the Israeli court is trying to justify.
Mr. Khatab, this is only one neighborhood. What about the other neighborhoods? You know, wherever you go, they have some pretext to simply ask the Palestinians to leave, either by force or by razing, you know, their homes to the ground in different ways.
It's one big case of apartheid and racism. But in Jerusalem, especially, the Israelis are very upset that they don't have full control on demographics, on the people of East Jerusalem, and therefore they are trying to find ways to weaken the Arab population and lessen the Arab population and replace them with Jews. It's such a blatant and naked view of racism in which individuals are being forced to leave so that another individual of a different race replace them. There's nothing clearer in ethnic cleansing than this case.
Mm-hmm. Mona, if I could ask you if we have had any reaction, because Sheikh Jarrah came in the spotlight a while ago, especially in May, and almost the most part of the world got to learn about it. We had protest rallies in different parts of the world. Anything planned so far?
Well, the Palestinian leadership and the Palestinian different political powers had been urging the international community to intervene in order to force the Israeli regime not to go ahead with the expulsion of the Palestinian families from Sheikh Jarrah. However, Palestinian families who are living in Sheikh Jarrah have been remaining in the neighborhood for months, not leaving their homes or their neighborhood. They were afraid that in case they leave their homes to any other place, even visiting the Al-Aqsa Mosque or other parts of Al-Quds, then the Israeli forces would bring the settlers. And this happened in the past. One of the homes where their family were outside their home, then the Israeli forces brought settlers and put them in that house, and they were not able to kick them out. So demonstrations and protests had been taking place across the occupied West Bank and in Al-Quds. Protesters have been trying to reach Sheikh Jarrah. However, Israeli forces were stationing at the entrances to Sheikh Jarrah. They were not allowing, and up to the moment, they are not allowing anyone from outside the neighborhood to enter it in order not to support and show solidarity with the families of this neighborhood.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Mona Kandil, our correspondent in Ramallah, Daud Khatab, international journalist and commentator, joined us from Amman. And that's it for this news review.
Welcome back. Yemen's armed forces, backed by local tribes, have made new gains in the oil-rich province of Ma'arib. The Yemeni army has advanced in from several directions, capturing strategic hilltops from the capital city of Ma'arib. Abdul Latif al-Washali has more.
New advances have been made by Yemen's armed forces, backed by local tribes, toward the oil-rich province of Ma'arib to liberate it from the Saudi-backed forces. The recent advances were made in conjunction with a major victory of the Yemeni army against the Saudi-backed militant groups in Al-Baida province.
Ma'arib is the center of the mobilization of the enemy forces, and therefore the Saudi-led coalition tried to distract the Yemeni army by opening other fronts, as happened in Al-Baida. But the Yemeni army is fully aware of all the evasions of the enemies. Ma'arib is now surrounded from all sides, and we control all the mountainous heights and strategic points overlooking Ma'arib. There is a small area in Bayhan. If the Yemeni army takes control of, supplies will be completely cut off to the enemy.
Military experts said the Yemeni army attacked the Saudi-backed forces in the Baqatha area and Rahaba Directorate of southern Ma'arib, as well as Al-Bilq al-Qibli Mountains overlooking the western neighborhoods of the city of Ma'arib. The Yemeni army, the experts said, is now surrounding the city from all sides.
Our forces managed to control the most important mountains and hills in Ma'arib, and the consecutive victories in Al-Baida gave our forces an advantage in encircling Ma'arib and besieging it from all sides. We have been able to liberate most of the southern and western regions. The battle is settled in favor of the Yemeni army, and the enemy is in a dire state.
For many months now, the Yemeni army has intensified its operations to take control of strategic Ma'arib province. Observers say Yemen's army has made remarkable advances against the Saudi-backed forces, meaning that Saudi Arabia is up to lose its last stronghold in northern Yemen. Yemenis say their army will eventually liberate Marib from the Saudi-backed forces and flip the table over Saudi Arabia and its allies. They believe that this is the only way to push Riyadh to stop its years-long war and siege and accept the political solution. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Lebanese Prime Minister designate says that the pace towards the formation of a new government is slower than what he had expected.
Frankly, with regard to the government, I was hoping the pace would be faster. It's going a bit slow. We wanted to form a government and announce it to the Lebanese people before August the 4th. August the 4th is a disaster that fell upon Lebanon and all the Lebanese people.
Najim Mighati made the remarks following a meeting with President Bashar al-Assad. He also said that his efforts to form a new cabinet will not be open-ended. Mighati was tasked with forming a government after the former premier, Saad al-Hariri, failed to muster support despite months of efforts. Lebanon has been run by a caretaker administration since a huge blast devastated Beirut's port in last August. The Mediterranean nation has been struggling with a crippling financial crisis that has pushed half the country's population into poverty. The ongoing political deadlock has further worsened Lebanon's already faltering economy. Malaysia's opposition lawmakers, angry over the postponement of a parliament session, have marched toward the legislative building to demand the resignation of Prime Minister Muhyiddin Yassin. The lawmakers, who chanted slogans against Muhyiddin, were stopped by police. The opposition leader, Anwar Ibrahim, delivered a speech accusing the premier of acting against the constitution. The parliament convened last week following months-long suspension due to a virus state of emergency, but its final session on Monday was postponed with a notice citing the detection of several COVID cases among attendees. The opposition, however, claims that it was a politically motivated move to dodge a no-confidence vote. Muhyiddin is at the heart of controversy since the king rebuked his government for misleading parliament over coronavirus laws. Public anger against the government's pandemic response has also led to protests calling for the premier to quit. And that is for World News. Stay with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. And hours and days after the 6th of January attack on the Capitol rattled Republican lawmakers knew exactly who was to blame. Donald Trump. loyal allies began turning on him. Top Republicans vowed to make a full break from his divisive tactics and dishonesties. Some even discussed removing him from office altogether. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Lisa Rehler and Nicholas Fandos. The piece is titled, Already Distorting January 6th, GOP Now Concocts Entire Counter-Narrative. Hours and days after the 6th of January attack on the Capitol, rattled Republican lawmakers knew exactly who was to blame. Donald Trump. Loyal allies began turning on him. Top Republicans vowed to make a full break from his divisive tactics and dishonesties. Some even discussed removing him from office altogether. By spring, however, after nearly 200 congressional Republicans had voted to clear Donald Trump during a second impeachment proceeding, the conservative fringes of the party had already begun to rewrite history, describing the Capitol riot as a peaceful protest and comparing the invading mob to a normal tourist visit, as one congressman put it. This past week, amid the emotional testimony of police officers at the first hearing of a House Select Committee, Republicans completed their journey through the looking glass, spinning a new counter-narrative of that deadly day. No longer content to absolve Donald Trump, they concocted a version of events in which those accused of rioting were patriotic political prisoners, and Speaker Nancy Pelosi was to blame for the violence. Their new claims, some voiced from the highest levels of House Republican leadership, amount to a disinformation campaign being promulgated from the steps of the Capitol, aimed at giving cover to their party and intensifying the threats to political accountability. This rendering of events, together with new evidence that Donald Trump had counted on allies in Congress to help him use a baseless allegation of corruption to overturn the election, pointed to what some democracy experts see as a dangerous new sign in American politics. Even with Mr. Trump gone from the White House, many Republicans have little intention of abandoning the prevarication that was a hallmark of his presidency. Rather, as the country struggles with the consequences of Donald Trump's assault on the legitimacy of the nation's elections, leaders of his party, who, unlike the former president, have not lost their political or rhetorical platforms, are signaling their willingness to continue, look past, or even expand his assault on the facts for political gain. The phenomena is not uniquely American. This is happening all over the place. It is so much linked to the democratic backsliding and rising of authoritarian movements, said Laura Thornton, the director of the Alliance for Securing Democracy at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. It's about the same sort of post-truth world. You can just repeat a lie over and over again. Because there's so little trust, people will believe it. Behind the Republican embrace of disinformation is a calculus of both ambition and self-preservation. With members of the Select Committee hinting that they could subpoena Donald Trump aides, allies on Capitol Hill, and perhaps Donald Trump himself, the counterfactual counterattack could preemptively undercut an investigation of the riot. As videos shown during the hearing gave harrowing new reminders of the day's violence, leading House Republicans claimed that Nancy Pelosi, a target of the mob, had been warned about the violence in advance, but failed to prevent it. From his private club in New Jersey, Donald Trump suggested that Nancy Pelosi should investigate herself, yet again falsely insinuating that Antifa and Black Lives Matter movement, and not his own followers, caused the destruction on 6th of January, and that a democratically decided election had been stolen from him. All the while, in the Senate, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the top Republican in the Senate, who once led his party in condemning both the riot and Donald Trump's role in it, made no visible attempt to stop the flood of fabrications, telling reporters he had not watched the hearing and had little new to say about the most violent attack on the Capitol since the War of 1812. House Republicans' desire to bury the attack on their own workplace has created a dysfunctional governing atmosphere. Nancy Pelosi has increasingly treated them as a pariah party, unworthy of collaboration or trust, and has expressed deep disdain for Representative Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader of the House, whom she called a moron this past week. "Anytime you mention his name, you're not getting an answer from me," Nancy Pelosi told reporters. "Don't waste my time." Almost as soon as the police retook control on 6th of January, hardcore defenders of Donald Trump in Congress began recasting the gruesome scenes of violence that left 5 people dead. Kevin McCarthy, the California Republican, responded differently at first. He angrily demanded that Donald Trump stop the rioters, according to an account he gave fellow Republicans at the time. Just a week later, as the House moved to impeach Donald Trump, Kevin McCarthy said that the president bears responsibility for the attack on Congress by mob rioters and called for a fact-finding commission. But in the months since, that early resolve has given way to an out-and-out intent to bury the attack. Kevin McCarthy, who is trying to win back the majority in 2022, moved quickly to patch things up with Donald Trump, gave latitude to far-right members of his caucus, and worked furiously to block the creation of an independent 9/11-style commission. This past week, just before police officers began to deliver anguished testimony about the brutality they had endured, Kevin McCarthy repeatedly laid blame not with Donald Trump, the rioters, or those who had fueled doubts about the election outcome, but with Nancy Pelosi, one of the invading mob's chief targets. "If there is responsibility for this Capitol, on this side, it rests with the Speaker," Kevin McCarthy said. Representative Elise Stefanik of New York, the recently selected House Conference Chairwoman, went even further, saying Nancy Pelosi bears responsibility as Speaker for the tragedy that occurred on 6th of January and deriding her as an authoritarian who has broken the people's house. "Ms. Pelosi is not responsible for the security of Congress. That job falls to the Capitol Police, a force that the Speaker only indirectly influences." Republicans have made no similar attempt to blame Mitch McConnell, who shared control of the Capitol at the time. Outside the Justice Department, meanwhile, a group of conservative lawmakers gathered to accuse prosecutors of mistreating the more than 500 people accused in the 6th of January riot. Encouraged by Donald Trump, they also echoed far-right portrayals of Ashley Babbitt, a rioter who was shot trying to break into the House chamber as a patriotic martyr whose killing by the police was premeditated. As if to show how anti-democratic episodes are ping-ponging around the globe, President Vladimir Putin of Russia in June seized on Ashley Babbitt's killing, calling it a political assassination. Some senior Republicans insist that warnings of a whitewash are overwrought. "I don't think anyone's going to be successful erasing what happened," said Senator John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas. "Everybody saw it with their own eyes, and the nation saw it on their television screens." For Mr. Cornyn and other lawmakers, continuing to talk about the attack is clearly an electoral loser, at a time when they're trying to retake majorities in Congress and avoid Donald Trump's ire.
Economic divide.
Two rivers in West Asia that could affect the destiny of a number of countries in one way or another. They're called the Tigris and Euphrates. But how is that possible? Hi, I'm Kabet Ahwai, and that is what we will be covering in today's program, in particular, how Turkey is manipulating the water of these two rivers for both its own political and economic advantage. Now, coming up in today's program, we're going to take a look at the two bodies of waters that are important here, the Tigris and Euphrates. Turkey has reduced water from them, impacting the land and agriculture of the surrounding countries, namely Iraq and Syria. So then we will take a look at Iraq and Syria, countries most affected by Turkey's reduction of water supplies, and how it damages both the land and the environment in those two countries. And finally, we're going to take a look at Turkey and zoom in on what its motives are, whether this is a manufactured water crisis that Turkey may be actually using with political motives in mind. Perhaps it's using it as a tool against Syria. What is Turkey's endgame when it comes to the two countries?
Water wars. The phenomenon has become very real in many parts of the world. The former UN Secretary General Boutros Ghalis once said, "The next war in the Middle East will not be over politics, but over water." That could be the situation between Turkey, Syria, and Iraq over the Euphrates and Tigris rivers.
حتى الشعب كوباني كله متأثرين من يعني من مي حتى المرضى من مي ما يحسنوا يشربون يعني يجي ريحة من مي ما بعرف وتعرف أردوغان عدو من آلاف السنين من أب الجدود.
These rivers are shared between Turkey, Syria, and Iraq. Turkey's alteration plans and usage has changed the river flows downstream, creating political tensions between the countries. The major problem has been Turkey's construction of dams. This has reduced water flows into Iraq and Syria by approximately 80% and 40% respectively. Keep in mind that approximately 90% of the water flow in the Euphrates and 50% in the Tigris originates in Turkey. Low flow rates in Iraq have allowed salt water to infiltrate nearly 150 kilometers inland from the Persian Gulf. Meanwhile, Turkey has accused Iraq of poor water management practices, which it says are exacerbating Iraq's water crisis.
The water crisis is threatening the lives of many Syrians and Iraqis, and Turkey has reduced the water levels of the Tigris and Euphrates to both countries to suit its own water crisis. But the root cause of the dwindling flow of the Tigris and the Euphrates is Turkey's southeastern Anatolia project, which is known as GAP. It's a series of dams that Turkey has constructed along the two rivers. They aim to double the amount of farmland in the Anatolia region and to generate hydroelectric power. Now, these dams must be filled annually, especially when there's a shortage of water. Yet Turkey is using the majority of the water from both rivers at the expense of Syria and Iraq. Okay, let's bring in our guest, Saad al-Mutallabi. He is an independent politician. And he's also a former member of the State of the Law Coalition and a member of the Baghdad local government. Saad al-Mutallabi, welcome. The falling levels of the Tigris and Euphrates, you're aware, it warns of an impending water crisis for both Syria and Iraq. Now, these two countries are already engulfed in economic and political crises. Both are accusing Turkey of using its many dams along the Euphrates to hoard this water. But the situation obviously could be more complicated. This great Anatolian project, or GAP, has been the source of this crisis. What is this situation, and is Turkey guilty?
Yes, as many people know now, water is the most important commodity in the country, and people just are talking about water, and the wars of the future will be dictated by the amount of water that each country gain or receive. Expanding populations and the expansion of the irrigated areas for agriculture and animal husbandry use. Therefore, water has become a major national defense issue, a national security issue. Therefore, it is very vital for Iraq to understand what Turkey is doing. The rebuilding or the expansion of building of dams in Turkey and affecting Syria and Iraq in such a way that it seems that there is a policy or a plan to deprive Syria and Iraq of the water resources that originate partly in Turkey. And Turkey is definitely using the water resources as a means for negotiations. I mean to add to the suffering of the people of Syria and possibly in Iraq. We all know that Turkey had a very important role to play in Syria and all the atrocities that took place in Syria, and ISIS's route to Syria was originated from Turkey. So therefore, it is national Iraqi security to deal with this issue, providing that the Iraqis know how to utilize their friendly relationship around the globe and not leave it for the bilateral relations between Iraq and Turkey alone, because Iraq will definitely, and Syria, will be in a disadvantaged position.
It's time now for our Info News section, where other economic news from around the world comes under focus. Our first country to look at is Lebanon. What a crisis this country is experiencing on multiple fronts. First, the Prime Minister designate Saad al-Hariri just resigned, further throwing the country into turmoil, especially economically. And while this country is in the throes of an economic catastrophe, well, you have the EU that is paving the way for sanctions, as if sanctions will help the country. It's almost as if it is meant to sink the country. It's a great topic for one of our upcoming programs. Now, moving on to Nigeria. Nigeria is experiencing a food crisis there. Soaring food prices are affecting the country. Inflation is nearing an all-time high. And as that has happened, then you have what's called rising unemployment, another economic factor that's in the negative here. And after taking a look at that, you have political insecurity. So the other crises, rising unemployment, and political insecurity, those are focused in the farming regions. And what that means is that it's going to plunge the nation more into financial despair, especially the middle class, as it was reported. Next to Libya. Libya has a major banking crisis. The UN actually made that announcement that it's at risk of collapse. So you're looking at the situation 10 years after the US-led NATO attack in that country, how obviously the country is not doing well. Now, the collapse is imminent if the country's two parallel central bank branches do not unify, because you have two parallel governments still running there, and hence the banking system running on two parallel dimensions is just not working. Finally, staying with Africa, we go to South Africa. Lots of unrest there, and at this point the unrest has subsided, but the looting after the former President Jacob Zuma was sentenced took a toll on the country economically. For example, $300 million in retail damages happened. You had 200 malls that were targeted, and over 800 stores that were looted there. So lots of economic damage in this COVID era happening to South Africa. Well, that does it for our Info News section. We're headed for a quick break here on Economic Divide. But do stay with us. We'll be right back after a quick break. It's time for our in-depth section of the program, and here is where we zoom in on the past to figure out how the situation has gone to where it is now. Well, it was the year 1975. The World Bank was the main financier of water constructions on river embankments of these two rivers. It forced Turkey to divide the needs of the three countries evenly against the average annual water flow. Then, moving on to the year 1987, Turkey reneged on this agreement then and signed one with Syria. That agreement granted Turkey 50% of the average annual river inflow in order to fill the reservoir of the Atatürk Dam until the end of the year 1993. Well, this therefore spelled the beginning of a crisis that is something that Turkey is responsible for. Since by reneging on this agreement that was financed by the World Bank, Turkey's position was that it did not recognize the Euphrates and the Tigris as international rivers. It declared them to be what's called transboundary waters. Now, what does that in effect do? Well, it subjects Turkey to have absolute control over the two bodies of water. This gives Turkey the right to decide freely how much water it allocates to other countries, taking what it wants to meet its own needs. And that is what the problem is. So what you have are agreements that are temporary, that are governed by political factors in the three countries and by developments on the ground, with Turkey holding the upper hand as it controls the waters of the Euphrates and the Tigris, which are Syria and Iraq's most important water resources. Well, in the meantime, Turkey has thrown out all of this out the door. In essence, it's saying that the allocations per capita in Iraq and Syria are sufficient to fulfill the requirements of these countries. Now, this chart over here actually shows the availability of the water when it comes to the three countries. And as you can see, from the year 1990 all the way through the year 2020, each of those countries have dwindling water resources. Of course, Iraq and Syria are affected more based on the way that Turkey has taken control of the water there. So there, that is obvious. Well, to break this down for us, we are privileged to have a specialist on this matter. His name is Ashok Aswain, and he's the UNESCO Chair on International Water Cooperation. He's also the Professor of Peace and Conflict Research at Uppsala University. Okay, Ashok, welcome to the program. Turkish leaders have previously stated that their country has the right to its water resources, just as Arab countries have the right to their oil resources. Now, do you think that this means that Turkey's ambition when it comes to the matter of the Euphrates for Syria and Iraqi oil and gas, while using water as a weapon to blackmail and pressure Syria and Iraq in order to achieve political and security gains, is actually what's happening?
You see, the two countries, particularly Iraq and Syria, are heavily dependent on the two rivers, which coming from mainly from Turkey. That's Euphrates and Tigris River. In the Euphrates River, 90% of water comes from the Turkey, 10% only from Syria. In the Tigris River, around 40% of water comes from the Turkey, 51% from my Syria, and then there is a 10% also from Iraq. But what has happened, the major water, most of the water comes from the most of the water of the Euphrates River, and quite a major portion of the water on the Tigris River comes from Turkey. And Turkey has been building this mega project, which is called the South Anatolia Project, and the Turkish acronym is GAP. In this, there are 22 dams and the 19 hydroelectric projects. But the thing is, this is Turkey argues that this project is important for its own economic development, its own water management. Turkey says that there is almost one third of its water sources are actually from this South Anatolia region. So I think it needs to develop this, and it has been building several major dams on the Euphrates River and also Tigris River, and that has affected the water supply to Syria and Iraq. Take, for example, Ataturk Dam, which is 40 billion cubic meters of water it can store. But then in the Euphrates side, Turkey, and because when Syria gets enters the water to Syria, that's only 32 billion cubic meters of water. And Syria gives to Iraq 25 billion cubic meters of water. So you can see that the major amount of water is already being stored in Turkey. Similarly, the dam in the Illishu Dam on the Tigris upstream, which has created such a huge problem also for the Mosul Dam downstream in Iraq. So I think Iraq and Syria both are seriously affected by this water being stored in the upstream, particularly in the Turkey's GAP, South Anatolia project or GAP project.
Its name is the Southeastern Anatolia Project. According to its website, it's a project based on the concept of sustainable development for the people living in the southeastern Anatolia region of Turkey. It's a large, sustainable, multi-sector, and integrated scheme. It is the largest of the 22 dams, 19 hydroelectric power stations, and network of irrigation canals that's being built in the Euphrates, Tigris, and Upper Mesopotamia basins. The project boasts fairness in development, participation, environmental protection, and jobs creation provided through the construction of infrastructure like airports and highways. Turkey's claim, in short, is that the GAP will double Turkey's irrigation, land, and hydroelectricity production to also increase the per capita income in the region by 50%. We ask, what about the downstream partners like Syria and Iraq? Turkey's dam construction has created a water crisis for those countries, adding to their destabilization. Let's not forget, the 2008-09 drought in Syria led to the displacement of more than 1 million people from the eastern regions of Daraa and Damascus. Crisis in turn will adversely reshape the two countries, affecting their populations, manufacturing, and production, and in turn, consumption. This may perpetuate long-term instability. This may spread to other countries in the region, as large numbers of Syrians and Iraqis would be forced to migrate from wastelands created due to the lack of water.
It's time to see what our guests think about the next question and whether they agree on it or not. Let's welcome back Said Al-Motalabi, independent politician who rejoins us, and also Ashok Swain, who is the UNESCO chair on international water cooperation. Okay, let me first start with you, Said Al-Motalabi. Water shortage in Syria and Iraq would have obviously an impact on political and societal stability in the two countries, which could lead to its transformation. Now, the 2008 or 2009 drought that happened in Syria, it was said to be one of the causes of the gripes that people had at that time. Will the water crisis in Syria, do you think, or even for that matter Iraq, that's caused by Turkey, considerably reshape the two countries, especially in terms of like population distribution, production methods, or consumption patterns, for example?
Yes, definitely. There we saw that in Syria there was a very direct involvement in Turkish involvement in the Syrian affairs. And definitely using water will definitely add to the influence, the Turkish influence in Syria and possibly Iraq. And it's not a secret that the Turks are using the dams to stop the flow of water into the two countries. With the suspicious results and suspicious intentions, Turkey definitely would like to increase its influence politically and economically in Syria and in Iraq, and maybe even more than that. We heard that there are calls in Turkey for regaining control of northern Iraq, Mosul, and the other areas, Nineveh. So yes, we are very suspicious of the Turkish activities regarding water. And Syrians are the same as in Iraq.
Well, Ashok, let me ask you then if you agree with Saddam Mutallibi or not, because in this case, we're looking at Turkey, the political, reasoning that it may have to try to take part of Iraq or Syria, as our guest mentioned there. I mean, we can't, again, forget, and I emphasize this, what happened when the drought occurred in Syria back in 2008-2009, in which there were a lot of people that went out and protested, which eventually led to the conflict that happened in that country and then eventually the war on Syria. Are we looking at Turkey trying to do that, do you think?
Yes, it is become creating a huge challenge for the downstream countries, Iraq and Syria. You see, in 2009, there are certain kind of agreement between the downstream countries, particularly Iraq and Turkey, and also with Syria somehow to manage this water. But that hasn't been after the, particularly in 2011, when the situation became worse in Syria. And you are right, the drought in 2008-9 affected the uprising in Syria quite significantly. What is happening now, we have seen the marshland in Iraq has been very heavily affected. There have been irrigation areas, particularly in Iraq and Syria, are quite affected because of water scarcity. There is a lack of water, basic water supply, particularly in Syria after the conflict, and as well as also in Iraq. So if we really want these two countries, Syria and Iraq, to get out of this the period of the conflict which they have gone through, they are now building, in a kind of phase where the conflict is moving towards a peace-building stage of some sort. The role of water, particularly the significance of water or water availability in the food production, in providing the basic water supply and the sanitation, and hydropower. Those are extremely critical things. And I think this is what happens if they don't have the water. There will be certainly, if not a kind of, these two countries have already faced quite a number of social uprising already before in recent years. So I think it will be certainly creating much more social problems. It will be really challenging the international community's hope for building peace in these two countries.
There's no telling where Turkey's water hoarding of these two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, will lead to. What's for certain is that its eventuality will happen sooner than later. After all, lack of water is not sustainable for the populations of, aside from Turkey, most importantly, Iraq and Syria. And since this risks the possibility of conflict, it may drag other regional countries into it, something that this region just can't afford. The solution is purely economical, how everyone can benefit from fair distribution of water through investment, for example. But the bigger question is whether Turkey is going to use this as a political tool or not. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. Your questions and comments are always welcome. From Mikhail Tahvei, it's goodbye. Until next time.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.